Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. This is a special episode of the Archive Project, featuring a staged reading of Words That Burn, a play by Cindy Williams Gutierrez, which won the 2017 Oregon Book Award for Drama. Words That Burn is a dramatization of the World War II experiences of William Stafford, Lawson Onata, and Guy Gavaldon. It brings to life the distinctive voices of a conscientious objector, a Japanese-American internee, and a Chicano Marine. It juxtaposes the history and perspectives of three World War II figures in their own words. Its reflections on conflict, race, and loyalty could not be more relevant today. This version is abridged by the author, directed by Gemma Whalen, with sound designed by Jonathan Swanson and run by Rosie Lambert. Recorded in the studio at Literary Arts in May 2018, it features actors Damon Kupper as William Stafford, Paul Soucy as Lawson Onata, and Anthony Green as Guy Gavaldon.
Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
It is war.
They put us on a train and say, go. A bell wakes up the engine as we move along past the crowd, and a child, one clear small gaze from all the town, finds my face. I wave. For long I look back. I'm not a soldier, I want to say, but the gaze is left behind, and I'm gone. During the war years, we who openly objected said goodbye and went away to camp or to prison. Some 12,000 of us of draft age went into the alternative service program called Civilian Public Service. Some 5,000 were sent to prison, and some unspecified thousands went into non-combatant service with the armed forces. The gazing sun goes out. The lid of day goes down with doubt. What war is won today? We all have done our work. We sing,
I have not killed a man,
not one today, for anything. Those of us who openly objected found our country conquered overnight, conquered by aliens who could shout on any corner or in any building and bring down on us wrath and hate more intense than on any foreigner. There was a fellow named Hidero Herrera from Coyote, New Mexico, and he could speak a little English, and I asked him about his draft board. He said they asked him,
why are you refusing to go to war?
God don't like war.
So where do you go from there? What could you ask next?
Hello, Lawson. This is President Roosevelt speaking. Now, as you may know, son, we're at war with Japan. So I'm going to have to put you and your family in camp.
3 years later, when the president died, we were still in camp.
I heard his voice while they were taking him away. And after he was gone, I could remember it. Arrest me. I hear it now.
Let us take what we can for the occasion.
Ancestry.
It began as truth, as fact. That is, at least the numbers, the statistics, are there for verification.
10 camps.
7 states.
120,113 residents.
Still, figures can lie. People are born, die. And as for the names of the places themselves, these, too, were subject to change. Denson or Jerome, Arkansas. Gila or Canal, Arizona, Tule Lake or Newell, California, Amache or Granada, Colorado. As was the War Relocation Authority with its mention of camps or centers for
assembly,
concentration,
detention,
evacuation,
internment,
relocation,
among others. The situation obviously was rather confusing. It obviously confused simple people who had simply assumed they were friends,
neighbors,
colleagues,
partners,
patients,
customers,
students, teachers of not so much aliens or non-aliens, but likewise simple, unassuming people who paid taxes as fellow citizens and populated pews and desks and fields and places of ordinary American society and commerce. Rumors flew, landed.
What's what? Who's next?
And then, just like that, it happened. And then, just like that, it was over.
It was a game to me. I didn't enjoy killing. The Marines were about to turn me down. I was a quarter inch too short, but less than 100 spoke Japanese.
Some say you're the Pied Piper of Saipan.
The first night I was on Saipan, I went out on my own. I always worked on my own and brought back 2 prisoners using my backstreet Japanese. My officer scolded me and threatened me with a court-martial.
Oh, don't you ever do that. This is the Marine Corps. It's teamwork.
But I went out the next night and came back with 50 prisoners. I conned them into surrendering after that.
What the hell? Let the little kid go. He's getting results.
There was a movie on your exploits. Hell to Eternity, 1960.
I had a lot of fun shooting it, but Jeffrey Hunter doesn't resemble me. He's tall with blue eyes. Me, I'm a short Chicano. Jeffrey was jealous he didn't have my good looks. Híjole. I came from such a large Latino family that no one objected when, at age 12, I moved in with my Japanese family. They were my extended family. I was there. I learned Japanese. We were all there, me, my buddies Lyle and Lane, Mr. and Mrs. Nakano, when we heard about this Pearl Harbor thing.
Your Japanese family was relocated to a detention camp in Arizona, and you decided to enlist in the Marine Corps at the age of 17.
The Japs, not the Japanese, bombed Pearl Harbor. My foster family, they were good Americans. I was not an interpreter. I went in to kill or take prisoners. If you didn't have the cojones, you couldn't do it. Everybody I killed died hard. I didn't enjoy killing. Freedom is not free. It costs an awful lot of blood.
Lost Boy was not his name. He had another name, a given name, at another given time and place, but those were taken away. The road was taken away. The dog was taken away. The good was taken away. The house was taken away. The boy was taken away. But he was not lost. Oh, no. He knew exactly where he was. And if someone had asked or needed directions, he could have told them. This is the fairgrounds. That's Ventura Avenue over there. See those buildings? That's town. This place also had buildings, but they were all black, the same. There were no houses, no trees, no hedges, no streets, no homes. But every afternoon, a big truck came rolling down the roads. It was full of water, cool, and the boy would follow it, cool. It smelled like rain spraying and even made some rainbows. So, on this hot, hot day, the boy followed and followed, and when the truck stopped and sped off in the dust, the boy didn't know where he was. He knew, but he didn't know which barrack was what. And so he cried. A lot. He looked like the truck. Until old man Aikida found him, bawled him out. Until old man Aikida laughed and called him...
Lost boy!
Until old man Aikida walked him through the rows and rows. The people, the crowd. Until his mother cried and laughed and called him...
Lost boy!
Until lost boy thought he was found. I've heard it said that the Japanese are one big tribe. There's something in the air between us, a spark of recognition that might be termed a tribal connection. No big deal, actually. Just history, pure and simple. Lineage, legacy. Let us take what we can. Follow the fire, those sparks of recognition.
We often fought fire in the company of state prisoners and servicemen, either not yet sent overseas or back here pending discharge. One bleak and frosty night, three of us sat hunched over a tiny campfire on the ridge above the fire line. I asked the wearer of a purple heart how he had received it. He said it was for the wounds he'd received while accounting for the lives of some vast number of Japanese.
53, I think.
Our companion was a prisoner, a Filipino, doing the 15th year of a life term.
I killed a Jap too, but I guess it was out of season.
No fooling. Is that what you're up for?
That's what I'm up for, but... If you think that's funny, here's a guy.
And he indicated me.
who's up because he refused.
I have not killed a man.
To kill Japs.
Not one today. For anything. We began to build a fire line, or cleared space, downhill, about 50 feet from the fire, which was still just a ground blaze and quiet from the night coolness and humidity. We built about 3/4 of a mile of line, working farther and farther from the fire as the day's heat allowed the flames to rise, and then we backfired it into the burn. It was a beautiful sight. As the midday wind came up, we sometimes had the breathtaking experience of seeing the fire crown in places within the burn and go roaring like a waterfall and spreading at runaway speeds. The things we have seen on fires... Men faint from exhaustion and be carried away on horseback like sacks of meal. United States soldiers on sit-down strike when the pack train with water failed to arrive. Men wall-eyed and trembling, shaken by an hour-long flight in terror before a runaway forest fire. Mexicans called out to fight fire and held without food or lights or guidance for 24 hours on the fire line. Shivering in their shirt sleeves, dressed as they had been when picked up from their railroad work down in the valley.
I hate to use the race card, but it was so obvious. On seniority, I should have been promoted to corporal. Based on what I accomplished, I should have been gunnery sergeant. Promotions were passed out, none for me.
You were recommended for the Medal of Honor by your commanding officer. However, the Marine Corps initially downgraded the award to a Silver Star and then upgraded it to the Navy Cross, one medal lower than the Medal of Honor, just as the movie was released.
I don't think the Marine Corps ever awarded the Medal of Honor to any Chicano in World War II. It was only with a twinge of conscience that they upgraded my Silver Star to a Navy Cross. And to me, that indicated they knew they had made a mistake. The fight continues. I don't want it. I enjoyed what I was doing. There was a time I wanted the Medal of Honor posthumously. Yeah, it sounds crazy, but I wanted to die for it. I'll give my life and show you. Many have wondered why I was so callous to the harshness of battle while only an 18-year-old kid. Being raised in the barrio, every day was a fight.
Your friends in Boyle Heights said that when you weren't playing with marbles with them, you were always picking a fight with somebody.
I was a 10-year-old in the ghettos of Los Angeles, shining shoes on Skid Row. Fighting in the Pacific tropical jungles and living in East Los Angeles ghettos had a lot in common. You had to be one step ahead of the enemy, or adios, mother. You're surrounded and have no choice but to surrender. Come out and you will not be killed. I assure you, you will be well treated. We do not want to kill you.
The arm is bayonet good, and the feet for marching. The eyes can lick over a blasted town and then read a menu. The voice can sing anthems for action and then pray. But the heart is not fit enough. It can't arm itself. It can't march. It can't even beat near a blasted town and then sing. The heart is rejected for military service or for essential civilian duty. What are you doing, heart? Heart, whose side are you on?
My uncle was going overseas. He was heading to the European theater, and we were all going to miss him. He had been stationed by Cheyenne, and when he came to say goodbye, he brought me a little bag of marbles. But the best one, an agate, cracked. It just broke, like bone, like flesh. So my uncle comforted me with this story. When we get home to Fresno, I will take you into the basement and give you my box of magic marbles. These marbles are marbles, so they can break and crack and chip, but they are also magic, so they can always be fixed. All you have to do is leave them overnight in a can of Crisco. Next day, they're good as new. Uncle, 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 what happened to you?
I killed 33. Good soldiers? Hell. They lost every battle against the Marines, whether it was at Guadalcanal, Tarawa, the Marshalls, Iwo Jima, and later even on their home turf, Okinawa. I killed 33 and captured over 1,000 Japanese.
Did you ever run into any Imperial Marines?
We were in no man's land, Jolly and I, and our troops were across the island. Suddenly, two Japanese soldiers came out of the building and stood at the door. It was my first encounter with Imperial Marines. I couldn't call out to Jolly without giving away my position, so I yelled at the Japs, "Teogete, hayaku, korosuktakunaira." They immediately turned towards me, and I could see they were not members of the Visitors Bureau. Very unfriendly chaps. I fired off 15 rounds point blank. They both fell. I reloaded my carbine. I could see that one Jap had gone to his just return, but the other joker was squirming. He had dropped his rifle, but his saber lay across his chest, the hilt in his right hand. I had shot off his left arm, and he had a few holes in his gut, but the stupid son of a swung out with his saber, and I was forced to send him to Valhalla. What a way to go. No pain. He had used me to commit suicide.
When are men dangerous? It was March 22nd, 1942. We had hiked into McNeil and found a few men loafing in the shade. We too relaxed for our Sunday afternoon. Bob set up his drawing board, George got out his tablet and pen, and I sat leaning against a telephone pole and began to read, Among Dangerous Men. About 8 of the townsmen gathered to look over Bob's shoulder as he painted. The men were cordial and curious. The only time we were abrupt was when they asked where we were from.
Magnolia.
George quickly changed the subject. One of the onlookers edged up behind George and looked over his shoulder. I went back to my book, and I'll never be able to remember whether I was reading when it happened.
Come, I will make the continent indissoluble.
The onlooker, a handsome young man, well-dressed, had snatched George's poem and was reading it.
Well, what's the idea of writing things like this? If you don't like the town, you haven't any right to come around here.
I was familiar with the edge on his voice. He knew we are conscientious objectors, COs.
Here, I don't want the poem. I'll take it and throw it away.
The young man held the poem away from George's outstretched hand and took his discovery to a few steps away to show it to other townsmen. The two muttered. The first man returned. He scrutinized Bob's drawing, while George and I stood without moving, and Bob went on painting a little faster. What could we do when men are dangerous? The young man spoke, not directly to us, but to the other townsmen, some of whom had drawn nearer, about our being COs. We began to hear the quickening words.
Yellow. Damn!
A short, strong man broke into action, went to where Bob was still sitting, and grabbed the drawing board.
Why, sir!
We'll take care of this.
The short man started to rip the drawing paper from the board, but another man stopped him.
Save that for evidence!
The short man raised the board over his head to break it over a piece of iron rail set like a picket near the depot. Then he stopped, considered, caressed the board, and settled down to hold it under his arm and to guard the evidence.
We ought to break that board over their heads.
Several others repeated the idea. Others revised the wording, expanded the concept, and passed the saying along. Some spoke of
stringing them up.
String them up!
George got constructive.
I guess I'll go home. I don't think they like me here.
He started to leave the circle. By now, there were about 15 men around.
Don't let him leave.
George came back and sat down. The young man who had started the Inquisition turned to me.
What were you doing?
I was reading a book. I held it up, Leaves of Grass, a poetry book. The young man veered to an accusation that George's writing was not poetry. There was an implication that if it wasn't poetry, it might be something else, like information for the enemy. George said that he thought what he had written, it was being circulated constantly through the crowd, exciting rumbles of anger wherever it passed, was poetry, and that poetry didn't need to rhyme. This opinion brought snorts from the crowd. The young man said that poetry always rhymed. Leaves of Grass throbbed under my arm, but I said nothing. The young man grabbed the book from under my arm and opened it at random. He read a passage aloud to the lowering group to prove that poetry rhymed. He started off confidently, read more and more slowly, and finally closed the book with a snap.
Well, that may be poetry, but what you wrote ain't.
The crowd was a little taken aback. It shifted its feet. By this time, I had a chance to look over his shoulder and read George's poem, which I hadn't yet done. It certainly was unfortunate. A Sandburgian description of McNeil beginning...
McNeil. Some town, McNeil.
An alert bystander clucked at a line in the poem.
And loaded freighters grumble through at night. There, that's information. That's them troop trains.
We lost all we had gained from Whitman. By this time, though, some of the group were arguing about why Bob painted. None of them could understand his insistence that he painted for fun.
But what are you painting that for?
They pointed to the old store building.
It must be for a foreign power.
I don't think a foreign power could use a picture of this store in McNeil.
The chief prosecutor bristled.
That's where you're wrong, bub. It's little towns like McNeil that's the backbone of this country, and Hitler knows it.
During all of this heckling and crowding, we were merely quiet and respectful. We didn't know what else to do. Finally, to our great relief, the police car from Magnolia rolled up. The policeman gave us the first friendly word in a long time.
That your work?
He nodded toward Bob's picture, still held by the evidence man.
That's pretty good.
The mob, at its greatest, numbered not more than 60, or possibly 75.
It got so hot in Colorado, we would start to go crazy. This included, of course, soldiers in uniform on patrol. So, once a week, just for relief, they went out for target practice. We could hear them shooting hundreds of rounds, shouting like crazy. It sounded like a New Year's celebration. Such fun is not to be missed. So, someone cut a deal just for the kids, and we went out past the fence. The soldiers shot, and between rounds, we dug in the dunes for bullets. It was great fun. They would aim at us, go, pow, and we'd shout, missed.
Many Japs committed suicide. It was sad to see children struggling with their parents, pleading them not to be thrown off the cliffs.
Please, Father, do not kill me. I do not want to die.
These parents were dangerous, desperate people who wanted nothing more than to kill the American savages who they thought would roast and eat their children. Hurley, look at all those people lined up on the edge of the cliffs. They're jumping off by the numbers. By God, man, we've got to stop them. Let's go. One group was about 200 yards away from us. I shouted at them as we ran. I'm begging them to stop killing their children, but I could see that as we approach, they jump off in greater numbers. Hurley, stop! If we get any closer, they'll all jump off. I'll try talking to them again. One, who apparently is a leader, is yelling at the rest. I can't make out what he's saying, but it's obvious that he's telling them not to surrender. The people look down at the rocks 800 feet below and see their friends moaning down there. Just about then, one of them grabs an infant and tosses him off. That seems to have been the signal because they all start jumping off. In a couple minutes, it's all over. The whole bunch lies down below, either dead or dying.
Animals full of light walk through the forest towards someone aiming a gun loaded with darkness. That's the world, God, holding still, letting it happen again and again and again. Which are the men who killed your son?
We all praising the deed he's done.
Where is the fate that made him die?
We, liking splendor, marching by.
Who makes war that stills his heart?
We, loving your son, we make wars start.
Suggest that you keep tuned to your Columbia station.
On July 7th, 1944, the battle to secure the Japanese-occupied island of Saipan peaked in one of the largest bonsai charges of the Pacific War. The charge lasted over 15 hours and brought the total losses for the island battle to over 30,000. The next morning, American Marine reconnaissance patrols edged their dangerous way forward to map out Japanese lines. As one patrol approached the sea cliffs which line the north side of the island, they were greeted by a rare sight. On the flats at the top of the cliff was a single American Marine, surrounded by hundreds of Japanese troops, many of them still armed. One might have thought that this Marine was experiencing his last moments on Earth, but as the incredulous scouts looked on, it became apparent that the lone Marine was actually ordering his hundreds of prisoners into smaller groups, even as more Japanese streamed quietly up from their oceanside caves. Eventually, 800 Japanese soldiers and civilians surrendered on this one morning.
It was in the morning of 8 July that I took two prisoners on top of the Banzai Cliffs. I talked with them at length, trying to convince them that to continue fighting would amount to sure death for them. I pointed to the many ships we had lying offshore waiting to blast them in their caves. Why die when you have a chance to surrender under honorable conditions? You are taking civilians to their death, which is not part of your Bushido military code. I understood that the Bushido code called for death before surrender, and that to surrender was to be considered a coward. This was going to be a tough nut to crack. It was either convincing them that I was a good guy or sushi, sashimi. I finally talked one of the two prisoners to return to the bottom of the cliffs and try to convince his fellow Gyokusai Banzai survivors that they would be well treated with dignity if they surrendered. He either had a lot of guts or he was going to double cross me and come back with his troops firing away. Who was the prisoner, me or the Japs? Here he comes, with 12 more military personnel, each with a rifle. This is it. I must keep my cool, or my head will roll.
Dozo o soare nasai.
Please, sit down. This is the first time that I think I'm being too young to demonstrate authority. But what else can I do? I offer them cigarettes. Okay. Let's get down to serious business. Haitai-san, I am here to bring you a message from General Holland Mad Smith, the shogun in charge of the Marianas operation. General Smith admires your valor and has ordered our troops to offer safe haven to all the survivors of your intrepid Gyokusai attack yesterday. Such a glorious and courageous military action will go down in history. The general assures you that you will be kept together in comfortable quarters until the end of the war. The general's word is honorable. It is his desire that there be no more useless bloodshed. The Japs didn't know General Smith from General Pancho Villa, but they respected the word shogun. The one in charge is a Chui, a First Louis. He reaches over and accepts a cigarette. A break. They're coming around. I try something else. The Japanese adage I learned in East L.A.
Ware ware, nihojin, toshite, hazukashi, koto o shitara, ikamasen.
We, as Japanese, should never do anything shameful. They smile, probably at my poor pronunciation. They know I am not Japanese. I look like a typical Chicano. The Chui asks me if we have well-equipped hospital at our headquarters. Madre mia, they are going to buy my proposition. I tell them we have fine, well-equipped doctors. The Chui gazes at the ships just a few feet off the cliffs. He has to know that to resist is sure death for all, me included. I can see this guy does not want to die, or he would have done himself in during last night's Gyokusai attack.
Sorayo, warrior ni naru.
My thought was, guy, you short, you did it. The Chui leaves four men with me and takes the rest of the troops over the cliffs. If I pull this off, it will be the first time in World War II that a lone Marine private captures half a Japanese regiment by himself. We wait and wait. In the meantime, we talk of their families, where they are from. I tell them about having lived with the Japanese Americans in California and my love for my foster family. I tell them that we, the common soldier, obey orders and reality have nothing to do with starting wars. They agree. In less than an hour, they start coming up. The lines up the trails seem endless. My God, how many are there? I might as well throw my carbine and sidearm away. If they rush me, sayonara. I can't remember how long. But I remember hundreds of Marines arriving on the scene.
This is what happens when a city is bombed. Part of that city goes away into the sky, and part of that city goes into the earth. And that is what happens to the people when a city is bombed. Part of them goes away into the sky, and part of them goes into the earth. And what is left for us between the sky and the earth is a scar.
Begin between the Golden State's highest and lowest elevations and name that location Manzanar. Rattlesnake a line southward to the zone of Arizona, to the home of natives on the reservation, and call those Gila, Poston. Then just take your time winding your way across the southwest expanse, the lone star state of Texas, gathering up a mess of blues as you meander around the banks of the humid Mississippi. Yes. Just make yourself at home in the swamps of Arkansas, for this is Roar and Jerome. By now, you weary of the way. It's a big country, you say. It's a big history, hardly halfway through, with Amache looming in the Colorado desert, Heart Mountain high in wide Wyoming, Minidoka on the moon of Idaho, then down to Utah's jewel of topaz, before finding yourself at Northern California's frozen shore of Tule Lake. Now, regard what sort of shape this constellation takes. It sits there like a jagged scar, massive on the massive landscape. It lies there like the rusted wire of a twisted and remembered fence.
Before leaving Saipan, I went to the stockade to bid adios to the many people I knew there. There were actually hundreds who I had personally saved from sure death. One guy, Shimabukuru, was a special friend. He had become my personal barber.
Gaisan, before you leave us, I want you to see someone here who you saved from jumping over the cliff. Do you remember that woman you grabbed right after she had thrown her baby to the rocks down below? The people who were there say that she screamed and fought you, but you held her down. Well, she lost her mind a few days after she was brought here to the stockade. It seems that when she realized that she had killed her child unnecessarily, that the Americans were not going to roast and eat the children, she became...
Hadari Maki.
Come, I will take you to her.
There she sat, motionless, just staring straight ahead. My God, what a pathetic sight. I should have let her join her baby that day at the cliffs. This was truly the horror of war.
Don't shut your eyes. When the war is over, many persons you know will probably have suffered. And I mean terribly.
Freedom is not free. It costs an awful lot of blood.
Most persons live year after year in a society geared as sure as shooting for war, and most persons don't protest. Some persons, however, mostly those you put in ivory towers, stand against stifling tariffs, against political insults.
Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry.
Against the use of the Navy for pressure in economics, against economic sanctions, against armament races. Your brother and mine go to the war. Our friends divide, some going into the war, some into war industries, some into peace groups. All think they're doing the right thing. All are the same persons we have known and liked before. Does one have to call others mistaken in order to be accepted as believing himself right? The address of my ivory tower is Los Prietos Civilian Public Service Camp, Santa Barbara, California.
Let's have one more turn around the barracks. Let's have one more go down the rows, rows, rows. Let's have one last chance at the length of the fence. Let's have one more turn of the lock, the key. Let's have one last look as I leave this morning, evening. All my belongings are gathered. All my connections are scattered. What's over the horizon? What's left to abandon? What's left to administer? Will anyone ever need another camp director?
He sat there in a camp library, a little man, about 5.5 feet tall, with dark eyes and a dark wing of hair that liked to hang over one eye. George was a man who sunk all of his spiritual capital into the cause of peace and reconciliation. He believed essential things like studying political problems should be done in one's spare time, but I had often found him far away before the record player. This time he sat down for a Beethoven concerto, a violin concerto, on his last night in camp. Tomorrow he was going far away, leaving his friends in a world otherwise alien. Doc, our loudest editor, asked George a question about the new issue of the camp newspaper. George answered shortly, abstractedly. Doc blundered on in his loud voice, not noticing how much George needed a little quiet. Now George had closed his eyes and was listening. Doc boomed on. George got up to change a record. Doc persisted.
The frogs were scraping away outside. They must have scraped on his nerves. The thought of leaving to go into a worse place than the camp. The thought of himself, a small man, alone, going into the unfriendly world. Doc kept on mutilating this last evening. And that is when George lashed out at Doc and the world. But Doc couldn't have known about that last part.
Go away! Go away and be still.
He motioned brusquely. And then he sat there in the wreck of his attempts on his last night in the Magnolia, Arkansas peace camp, with his favorite record music in his hands, and he didn't look up, just sat hunched on the floor with his small feet out in front and his wing of black hair over one eye.
Wow. The music speaks for itself. And it certainly spoke to me. It called me. Called me by name.
Lawson. Lawson.
And I certainly listened. Yes, I listened to its warm and gentle voice. Its soothing, beautiful voice. As it told me, showed me its home. That special place. Here it was. Calling me, talking to me, showing me, soothing me. The music. Yes, I could feel it.
Hey, Lawson! What are you doing?
Nothing, just listening.
So come on in, it's cold outside.
And there, wonder of wonders, was not just a radio, but a record player. Let us take what we can for the occasion.
You like that?
Yes.
You wanna hear it again?
Yes.
You know what it is?
Yes. Mood Indigo by Duke Ellington. So I just stood there and listened. And when I went outside again, it was certainly Mood Indigo. Winter Dusk, Jerome Camp, Arkansas. Years later, there's an 18-year-old kid, ostensibly a student in the San Francisco Bay Area, hanging around the Black Hawk Club again. He's still underage, but the waitresses don't know that. Besides, he seems to be a friend of the musicians, or at least they acknowledge him when he says, "Hi, Miles," or "Hello, Coltrane." And they say things like,
"Hey, man, what's happening?"
On this night, however, he's gone outside during intermission. It's cold, foggy, and he's leaning against the wall under a streetlight. No one else is around. Except for a woman, likewise leaning against the wall. It's quiet. A car goes by, tires hissing in the mist. The young man, the woman, stare into space. After a while, in a hushed voice, he speaks. "Excuse me, but may I have your autograph?" Her face lights up as she smiles.
"Why, certainly, son. What's your name?"
He tells her, and she pronounces it, somewhat sings it, as she writes it in the book. And then, still smiling, she looks him straight in the eye and says,
"You were here last night."
"Yes, I was, ma'am. I've been here all week." "And you might say he never left." And what she wrote in that book, her book, was this: "For Lawson, sincerely, Billie Holiday." And before he knew it, he was writing poetry.
We had to work hard all day in the camps, so we would quietly get up at 4 a.m. and make our way to the library, where we could read and write till breakfast call. Since those days, I've had the habit of writing early in the morning.
I always worked on my own, using my backstreet Japanese.
Making these word things to step on across the world, I could call them snowshoes. They creak, sag, bend, but hold over the great deep cold, and they turn up at the toes. In war or city or camp, they could save your life.
You're surrounded and have no choice but to surrender.
Let us take what we can for the occasion. Ancestry.
You can muse them by the fire.
Come out, and you will not be killed. I assure you, you will be well treated.
Let there be order.
Be careful, though. They burn or don't burn in their own strange way when you say them.
We do not want to kill you.
Let us be wise.
In war
or city
or camp,
they could save your life.
That was a staged reading of the play Words That Burn, a 2017 Oregon Book Award winner. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.